Mark.
Greetings.
Greetings and salutations, or whatever they say.
Indeed. That is correct, sir.
So what's going on?
It's hot.
Yeah? Do you have air conditioning?
We have a couple window units. But I don't have anything running in here because I have a fan that I could put on, but it probably would make noise.
Because you want to sweat?
Yeah. I'm gonna sweat through it.
It's like working out while you're podcasting.
Yeah. Maybe I'll lose a couple pounds talking about comics.
That's the best way.
I just say, for some reason, I don't do it on purpose. For some reason, I always end up eating I always eat an early lunch before we podcast, so I don't get, so I'm not starving by the end. And for some reason, I tend to eat something spicy. So I was already sweating because of that, because I had made a burrito out of leftover portobello slices from last night. I put hot sauce and jalapeno peppers and a bunch of other stuff on it.
Yeah.
I've been really increasing my heat tolerance. It's definitely...
That's awesome. I'm impressed. Because yesterday on Friday I had a green chili Philly. And then yesterday we had green chili pizza. And this morning I had an egg sandwich with... what is that? Spicy cheese? Can't think of it. But it's got the peppers in it and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was good.
Yeah, it's definitely something that the more spicy stuff you take in, you build up a tolerance.
And you need it. It's like a drug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you go after more. Like I like that sriracha sauce.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, but...
Yeah, that's you get at Chinese restaurants, the red stuff.
Yeah. We had a bottle of it that lasted a super long time, and then this most recent bottle, it's almost gone. We've only had it for a month, I think. just putting it out of everything.
On your cereal?
Yeah.
Instead of milk?
Yeah, that's actually... That's what Kara told people the other night, that I was putting jalapenos in my cereal. I said, that's not true. I dip them in my coffee.
There you go. Instead of just having dark coffee, you put some sriracha sauce in there.
There you go. But actually, in college, we used to sometimes go in the morning to this... Vietnamese food stand that sold noodles, and it was they like noodle soup, and they had sriracha sauce on every table, and it was a popular place for people that were hungover, and they would go and get like Vietnamese noodles, and they put a bunch of sriracha sauce in and mix it into the broth and like sweat out their hangover.
So that's a recipe for hangovers,
I guess.
Noodles and sriracha sauce?
I guess so. I don't know why sweating would help, because part of the problem when you're hungover, I think, is because you're dehydrated, but...
Yeah.
Who knows? People try anything, I think.
Cool deal.
But, yeah, it's been a long week, because it started off, my parents' cat, he's 11, and he wasn't doing well. And he's kind of, they started giving him, prednisone, which is helping. So he's bounded back a little bit. He started eating again.
Prednisone, though, makes you hungry even when you're not hungry.
Yeah. Which may be helpful to him, 'cause he just wasn't eating at all. Because he's got, a tumor of some sort. They're kind of in a place with him of gauging his quality of life. He seems to have bounded back a little bit and still has some quality of life, but my mom is very attached to him. he's kind of like her shadow and has been for most of the time that they've had him. He follows her around the house and always sits with her and stuff. So I had that going on, and Luna was our dog was starting to have some issues. She was losing hair and she threw up a few times, so I was worried about her. So like, I can't have all this going on at the same time. Fortunately, I mean, there is something wrong with her, but it's not a terminal thing. It's she has a skin infection, which I guess the vet said for older dogs with a thick coat like hers.
Yeah.
It is common in the summer. So she's on an antibiotic, and we're giving her a bath with a special shampoo 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Which she's not a dog that really enjoys water. She doesn't really like taking the baths. We put her in a kiddie pool in the backyard, and Karen and I have to do it together so she doesn't run away. But I think she likes it once she's done. She cracks us up because all of a sudden she's like a puppy again. She goes in the house and runs laps around the downstairs.
She gets adrenaline,
I guess, because she feels cooler all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was hilarious yesterday because I was standing at the top of the stairs and she was at the bottom of the stairs and she would look up at me and then I'd hear her take off and run a circle around the house and all of a sudden she would appear again a couple seconds later. She'd stop and stare at me and then take off again. I was just dying. But but she's just, I mean, she's got some bald spots that have seemed to stopped
getting worse.
Yeah. And but she's just, I mean, normally she sheds a lot in summer, but this is just unforeseen. I mean, we're picking it up as we see it, but I'll be doing like my weekly sweeping this afternoon, and I'm just anticipating an insane amount of hair because it's just everywhere you look.
Yeah.
And we come home from work and it's just everywhere.
She's eating okay?
Yeah. She's always been kind of a finicky eater. But she is eating. And it does seem to be improving. The vet was pretty reassuring that, that this was normal and that's for her age. And because she's part husky and stuff, so her coat is just insanely thick. I mean, the amount that she's shedded and that she still has the amount of fur on her that she does, that's why she loves the winter so much. It's just, that's her element. It's just trying to keep her cool, and which is always a challenge in the summer. She wants to, like this morning, she kept wanting to come upstairs and just to get her to stay downstairs where it's cooler in the fan, and is a challenge sometimes. But Kara's attending to her now and keeping her down there. She doesn't tell her she can be on the podcast some other time.
Cool.
Yeah, so we've had some adventures. And my grandfather had, beginning of the week, I was anticipating his open heart surgery.
Jeez.
On Wednesday. So I had all that on my mind at the beginning of the week. Unfortunately, everything is kind of, as the week went on, everything turned for the positive.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, he had 5 bypasses done, and everything went successful. On Thursday, he was already in his own room, out of intensive care, and they actually discharged him yesterday.
Wow, that's quick.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I mean, I think, who knows what essentially causes all this, that type of thing. I think he was just sort of, some of it was genetics and some of it was, that generation. My other grandfather was the same way. I didn't know them to smoke, but they smoked kind of up until around the time that I was born, when they were about 50 or so. Because that was when, like, education, late 70s and stuff, when education about cigarettes got a lot stronger.
Mm-hmm.
So all my grandparents quit, but they smoked long enough that it had the effect on them. on the long term. And whatever reason, because he's always very active. This is my dad's dad. And they kind of said that, you know, the amount of blockage that he had, if he hadn't been so active and thin as a result, he would have had a stroke.
Yeah.
And that's part of the reason he probably recovered so quickly.
Is he still smoking?
No. I mean, he hasn't smoked.
Oh, okay.
He's 81, so he hasn't smoked in decades.
It's already done a lot of damage.
Yeah, it was the same thing with my other grandfather who passed away about 5 years ago or something. Yeah. He ended up having lung issues in his late 70s and stuff, and he hadn't smoked since he was 50 or so, but they both smoked long enough to do some damage, you know?
Yeah. How they plasticize things in that human, I forget they call it, when they have the models of the human body and they plasticize them so they'll stay intact and you can see like the veins mm-hmm. and all that stuff. They usually travel like the natural history museums.
Yeah, I think it's called Body Works.
Yeah, Body Works.
Yeah.
They have like a lung or the different stages of a smoker's lung, and it's pretty freaking frightening, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just the color, it turns like to coal.
Yeah.
It doesn't even look this like a lung, you know?
No, it goes from pink to
black.
Black, practically, yeah.
Yeah. I would die because I have asthma, so.
Yeah, well, that kind of, I mean, I flirted with cigarettes and stuff in college, but.
Yeah, you want to come inside me?
Yeah. You know, I'd walk into the store and wink at the packages, and the cellophane wrapping would just fall off. But, I have some exposure to the addictiveness of them, and one of my friends in college is, as far as willpower, is one of the strongest people I've ever known. And to see him struggle, he smoked a lot more than I did, and to see him struggle with quitting, I can tell from that it's a difficult thing to do. So it's very, I understand it's very addictive, but yeah, the damage it does to your body is just amazing. You know, yeah. Seeing a lot of just like medical reports on elderly people who have smoked, it's crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had a weird week too. Last week, I had this like bump on my head that just kept growing. And I was like, what the hell is this shit, right? And mm-hmm. I popped it, and it, like, wouldn't stop bleeding. Like, it was like a sieve. And I'm like, what the hell's going on? And I finally got it to stop bleeding. Went to the doctor, and they said, you need to go to a dermatologist. Mm. And it turns out to be, like, a pyrogenic granuloma, which is this weird thing, a vein in your head or something. Mm-hmm. I think it comes infected, and there's nothing you can do except have it removed and then they burn it, you know, they cauterize mm-hmm. it because it just keeps bleeding. But yeah. Man, it was weird. I've never I usually clot, my blood clot, you know, like if I have a bloody nose or it doesn't take long for it to stop, you know.
Yeah.
This time it was just, I was like gushing blood at work and I was like, holy crap, I better go home.
Wow, that's freaky.
Yeah, so I had that burned off. And the week has just been weird, man. It's been a hell of a week. So I was glad for the weekend.
Yeah, my dad's had a few things removed from his back like that. And it's always, until you can get a chance to have it tested and everything like that, it's always freaky anytime you have an oma of some sort, granuloma or any kind of oma, you know.
Yeah, as long as it's not melanoma, that's the right. Cancer, so...
Yeah,
this one they don't think is, but it's. I still haven't gotten the results back, but it's pretty much what they said because of the amount of blood that it does. Mm-hmm. Wow, this is a weird episode. Yeah.
Yeah. Medical noise.
Medical retro noise.
But yeah, no, I think. That's probably precautionary testing. I mean, I think generally granulomas are benign
yeah.
in general. So
it was a weird thing, man. It was like, it was right on like the side of my head, and it just looked like a bulb of blood. It's disgusting.
That is pretty. And naturally, I mean, we read comics. The first thing I think of when you say that is that some kind of like small creature is going to pop out and.
Yeah, I was making fun with Barb, and I was like, I'm turning into an animal. I would say, I'm not an animal. There was this movie, man, it must have been in the 90s, or maybe it was the late 80s, called The Dark Backward. Have you ever seen that?
No.
It was with Judd Nelson. It's such a weird, dark comedy that I don't even know why they made it, but It's about this guy that grows an arm out of his back. You know, it just starts as a stub and it turns into an arm.
Mm-hmm.
And, man, it just reminded me of that.
Well, that's what I love about the 70s and the 80s. They made a lot of movies that would never get made today.
Well, there's Sharknado or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. those like sci-fi movies and stuff are definitely a source of... I think the difference in those ones, like, that they do, like, they're funny to watch sometimes, but I always appreciate more practical effects. And back when they had to do stuff, like, I almost rather have, like, a cheesy-looking real special effect than a cheesy-looking computer-generated special
right,
effect.
Right, because you can make it look more, whereas in the true B film, they couldn't afford it. It was a matter of money.
Right.
So they were, like, being strategically... They were like, how can we make this look somewhat cool?
Mm-hmm.
But it's not going to look like they wanted it to look. They knew that.
Mm-hmm. No, and some of what they did with pretty limited budgets, like, you know, is pretty fantastic. I mean, like, you had people turn up and make a career out of the fact that they were really... you know, artists with that kind of a thing, like Tom Savini and people like that, that just, it's always interesting to see these creative methods that they figured out. Like, okay, when they had to figure out if, and like maybe Friday the 13th, one or two, they had to figure out how to do a beheading, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And just like the artistry and like creativity that goes into figuring out how to do that and not make it look, you know, totally fake, you know, even if you could tell a little bit, you know. So.
Yeah, Savini is good, though. Like, everything he did looks pretty cool. Like, I've seen some cheesy films, like, that's just horrible.
Mm-hmm. No, it's like guys like him. They might have used the same resources. They just had, you know, they had a real talent for doing a lot with little, you know.
Yeah. Have you ever seen Ed Wood?
Yeah, the black and white.
Yeah, the one with, I think the guy was nominated for Best Supporting Actor. I don't know if he won. He played Bela Lugosi. But his movies, man, they're really bad.
Yeah.
But I still watch them. I think they're hilarious. They're fun. They're fun to watch. Sometimes, it's good to watch that shit every now and then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
everything so damn serious.
Right. Yeah, and the movie Ed Wood itself is a really good movie though.
Oh, that's a spectacular movie.
Yeah.
The guy who played Bela Lugosi and even Johnny Depp did a kick-ass job.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one for sure. So what order do you want to do our segments in today?
Last week, did we do the Kirby stuff last? Do you want to do that first?
Yeah, it sounds good. I think last time we actually did questions, then random, and then Kirby. So
okay.
Yeah, we can kick into some Kirby. This time we had, let's see...
Detective New Gods. Turpin number one.
Yeah. New Gods number 8. We had Jimmy Olsen 148. And then we had Mr. Miracle number 8 as well, which I think was my favorite Mr. Miracle.
Oh, it's been winning every week that it's yeah. out.
New Gods is pretty close for me too, though. That was
I had a different opinion. New Gods was my least favorite.
Oh yeah.
And Jimmy Olsen was my next favorite.
Your middle tier.
Yeah.
All right. Well, New Gods number 8.
But to be fair, I read number 8 really late at night.
Yeah, sometimes
it could make it
affect things.
Yeah, it could affect things. I did see. I think his art though in this was a little bit not as detailed. There wasn't as much line work, like on Calibac and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of lines on Turpin's face, but I guess on Calibac was where I noticed it the most.
Yeah, that's interesting because I didn't know if I was being too critical or not, but I noticed some panels later on towards the end of Orion without his helmet and whatnot looked a little more looked a little rushed.
Yeah, this issue did look a little rushed. I mean it was still great, but it just looked a little different, especially for New Gods, because usually New Gods like pops, like it's in your face.
Yeah, it usually is pretty solid. Otherwise, God forbid, considering the amount of output that Kirby was producing, something looked a little rushed. I'm surprised it doesn't all look rushed. It's amazing, but
yeah, I love the cover though. It's mm-hmm. like Ryan's like, stay back, let Turpin die.
Yeah, basically.
Don't let him have this fight. Let him fight Calibac by himself.
Yeah, this is a personal combat, so you can't interfere. Which is a little bit of a twist of the contents, because it really comes down to Turpin being on the sidelines somewhat while Orion and Calibac are being allowed to sort of do their thing. But Turpin, I kind of was the centerpiece of the issue that I enjoyed was, we haven't seen him much recently, but he's the detective that is close to retirement. You know, he's made his career on busting mobsters and whatnot. And, when we last saw him, he was sort of making the point that whether it's mobsters or super beings from other planets, it all kind of amounts to the same. And his whole deal is, you're not going to make a mess of my city, whether you're a good guy or a bad guy. And his chief of police is a young guy who basically wants to protect him and keep him from getting himself killed right before retirement. But Turpin's not having that.
He's like the Danny Glover in Lethal Weapon.
Yeah, basically.
I'm getting ready to retire, but I can't have that.
Yeah. So,
and the other thing that was cool is we finally see, like, the characters that supposedly had the anti-life equation that Darkseid captured again. At least 3 of them.
Right, yeah. The ones that have been helping out Orion and whatnot actually really are... Since they've been brought back to Earth, haven't really been in harm's way too much, and they're right in the mix of it. I mean, we see that that even though Orion rescued him, the fact that he's continued to associate with these folks has made them a target, because Calibac has come looking for Orion, and he knows that Orion's associated with these people, so that's who he goes to, and he basically kind of uses them as hostages to draw out Orion.
The mass directing mechanism guided him to the target.
Yeah.
And that one detective guy and Claudia are Dave and Claudia are the first ones to get it, and he just fires off a whole round of shots at Calibac and it does nothing, and then he Then he throws his gun at him.
Yeah.
And then he tries to go in hand-to-hand combat with him. It seems like he would have been crushed right there.
I know. I like how all the men are you know, like old school Hollywood macho guys. You know, they're like, they're gonna go up against a demigod from another universe, and you know, throw their gun at him and then punch him in the stomach.
And he speaks in the third person.
Yeah.
He says Dave Leakin can take care of himself.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah, his attitude's pretty similar to Detective Turpin's.
Yeah.
In this issue. And I like how the you know, the police that are getting sent out to deal with the disturbance that Kalibak is creating, you know, they make a point to tell them to grab their weapons from the new stuff that they've ordered, because they got you know, pretty sci-fi Kirby looking weapons instead of their usual pistols. So they're armed with some kind of, somehow they've gotten some new technology.
Kind of like in modern comics, you know, Turpin had the, what is it, the science unit or whatever, the MCPD, I can't remember what they're called, but they had all kinds of fancy weapons to deal with stuff when Superman wasn't around.
Yeah. Yeah, and it does seem kind of like
Turpin would armor up.
Yeah. Yeah, he doesn't. He just kind of heads into battle wearing his suit and bowler cap this time. He's got a little weapon of his own that looks pretty sci-fi. But you know, and he's got a plan. He's got some weaponry. But as far as his own, as far as his own body, he's not too concerned with protecting it.
So
pretty messed up.
Orion and Lightray arrive and decide they see a loving couple up there. And then they go to an elevator, and they have an elevator ride with a groovy chick that invites them to a party.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the other things that I really liked about this issue was Light Ray.
Yeah.
Just how, you know...
Mr. Personality.
Yeah, just joyous and polite, and, you know, he's very pleased with the invitation that he gets to the party, and... Orion's, you know, all business, and you know, he says no means no female. Frivolity is far from my thoughts.
Yeah. But
she doesn't care. She's just amused by the way that they talk, and you know, they end up connecting with the older man of the quartet that Orion had associated with, Victor Lanza, who's had some heroics of his own in the past, and we get to meet his wife, who is pretty taken with Light Ray and his manners, and also, you know, the way that they talk. But their television news report is what you know, clues them into what Kalibak is doing over at, you know, Dave Lincoln's apartment building.
Orion just lifts the TV set up.
Yeah.
Like, what is this?
Light Ray says, Orion, be careful. That's a functioning household product. An authentic electronic period piece. Like, yo, dude. Don't bust up the people's.
So I love this panel, too. And the cops are firing at Kalibak, and the weapons are doing pretty much nothing. And then like, Turpin decides to do, like, a Nick Fury, like, in the Howling Commandos move, shooting his gun, and gets, a whole part of a building just blasted on him.
Yeah, that leaking.
And he keeps losing clothes, of all the people. His clothes just keeps tearing.
Yeah, seriously. He's, like, he's losing clothes like Rogue in a 90s comic. I'm surprised he's like not, you know, he's gonna be down to his bikini briefs by the end of the episode almost. his shirt has seen better days by the end of the episode. It's basically just hanging off of him and by the cuffs.
Yeah, Orion luckily saves him though, because he has him like he's gonna toss him like to his death, you know, like just holding him above his head, and then Orion shows up and pulls him back, and then they start fighting.
But I do love Turpin in this episode. I mean, always a sucker for the underdog and the mortal human that's willing to go up against, you know, super-powered beings, and he just gets destroyed. I mean, he gets the crap beat out of him. He's almost dead. But, you know, he does affect the sway of the battle, and I love that he's, you know, he's hardly alive, and he's still trying to, not only is he going to take Kala back in, you know, he wants to arrest Light Ray and Orion, too, because they're part of the battle that's causing all this damage, and his focus is just on protecting his city.
Yeah.
You know, which is pretty cool. But I'd say the other really pretty significant event that we have here ending things up is that, you know, as a result of the battle between Orion and Kalibak, Orion's, you know, helmet is lost, and, you know, his true face is revealed. The, you know, that's been a reoccurring plot throughout these, that he has a true face that reveals him to be look more of
just like his mother.
Yep. Like his mom.
Only the face a mother can love.
Yeah. And
another key thing is Turpin has that one weapon that they actually fire at Kalibak when he's in shock looking at his face.
Yeah. Yeah, that manages to... They have to use the electrical power of most of the city to even power it, and all it does is manage to knock Kalibak out, but Turpin's encouraged, you know, that they managed to do that, and since they found a way to do that, he's believing that they'll find a way to hold him.
And then he's allowed to pass out.
Yeah.
I've did my job. I can pass out now.
Yeah, one of the cops is pretty impressive. He says, Turpin's got to hide like a bull rhino.
And I think this is
tough
the
old guy.
The first time that Orion saw, I mean, Light Ray saw Orion's face.
Yep.
And he kind of just said, hey, I saw scars both new and old taken in the cause of New Genesis. So he's like blowing it off.
Right. Because Orion says, you're a good friend, Light Ray. So in other words, Light Ray knows it's not just scars that he's looking at, but it's his way of saying, what do you mean? I didn't see anything, you know?
Mm-hmm.
In other words, your secret's safe with me kind of thing. So it's kind of a neat development to their relationship.
Yep. And then we get another short one, Fastback. This reminded me a lot of when Lightwave was trying to outrace the Black Racer.
Yeah.
You know, we saw that in one of the early issues of New Gods.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like Fastback, except in the Light Ray situation, Light Ray was the one that could have seen death. And this one, it's another being that Fastback's trying to get to.
Yeah, they're sort of racing each other to Isak. Yeah, I think it's the second time we've seen Fastback, right? And it was also in a backup, I believe.
Yeah, in a backup. And probably the second time we've seen Isak, too.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think we don't really even get a good look at him here, but I think we have seen him once before as
well.
Yeah,
he was the young boy. Okay. I think I think he showed up in Forever People.
Mm-hmm.
He was the only name that they mentioned in all those kids.
Yeah.
That's why I remember him.
Gotcha. But, yeah, I mean, these backups are never all that substantial, but it does give, you know, they usually do give a sense of a larger, you know, world around the fourth world.
Yeah, I did like the Lonar ones a lot, and I like the Mr. Miracle ones, like, you know, like mm-hmm. when he's back at the school, and it just gives you a little peek of what it was like.
Yeah, I agree that those are probably the better ones. I especially the Mr. Miracle ones, seeing Scott Free. I mean, that's a major character. It's good to get some background on him.
Yep. So and this next issue brings back Vince Coletta. We haven't seen him in a while. We've seen Mike Royer inking, which Mike Royer tends to, I think, make Jack Kirby's art look more Jack Kirby-ish. And Vince Coletta mm-hmm. tends to make his art look more like the art of that time, I guess. Is this a Neil Adams cover? Because it looks like a Neil Adams Superman there.
You're right, it does. I'll flip back to the table of contents here, and Yep, you're right.
That looks like a Neil Adams Superman.
Yep, that's a cover artist, Neil Adams. Only one in this volume, I think. No, the last Jimmy Olsen was also him with Murphy Anderson. So, yeah, you know, I think when as like a comic book reader, you know, over time you get better and better at understanding and recognizing the effect of different inkers on pencilers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a, something I think that, I mean, I feel that takes time to develop, and it's different with every artist too. And I think having a lot of Mike Royer for a while, it felt a lot more apparent to me hitting this issue, the difference between them.
Oh yeah.
You know, before we started doing the series, I don't think I really understood the difference as well as I do now. I could probably do a pretty good job of picking out just looking, like, you know, whether Kirby is inked by Coletta or Royer at this point. But yeah, I mean, I felt this issue, like, overall was less of a less tied into the fourth world and more so just of a
it was a two-shot. In other words,
yeah.
It was a two issues of an adventure fighting Victor Volcanum.
And that's not a like a good or a bad thing, you know, but just something I observed about it, you know. This being the title that I think DC felt, you know, has the most interest and stake in at the time, you know.
Yeah.
I find it kind of interesting that it's. At one point, it felt really tied into the fourth world and where a lot of the developments were happening. But if, as time's gone on, it feels a little more of its own.
Mm-hmm.
They're all like you could read all of them kind of on their own, each title. But this especially is feeling a little more like its own thing.
Yeah.
But
so last we left off with. The Newsboy Legion and Jimmy Olsen being dropped into the pits of a volcano in the form of a cage, and Superman was being crushed by two rocks, and it kind of takes off where that left off. Mm-hmm. And Superman manages to break the rocks and save the Newsboy Legion, and Victor Volcanum doesn't seem to be that bothered by it because he thinks that he's pretty much built. This gives the backstory of Victor Volcanum, and I didn't understand why he became bad because he was a balloonist. And he loved to balloon, and he just fell into a volcano one time, started running out of food, and started building robots. And these robots started building more robots, and he just started drinking fire, which made him immortal. And then I guess in the process of being with these robots and being in the volcano by himself, he decided he wanted to take over the world.
Yeah, I guess Superman says it in a sense when he says he believes this story, but after all those years of isolation, you've been driven into paranoia.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess living in a volcano and with only robots for your company will turn even a balloonist insane. But yeah, it's interesting. I wonder if any other supervillains ever had that origin story.
Yeah.
Pretty unique.
He sends these robots after, you know, Superman and the Newsboy Legion after Superman rescues them. And there's this really cool panel where Superman just picks up a rock and he launches it at super speed.
Mm-hmm.
And it just like crashes through about like, what, seven soldiers' helmets all at once and takes them all out.
Yep.
That looks awesome. It's like, zonk, baps, back, crash, zip, wham, pow, crack.
Yeah, I do like that it goes, each one has a different sound effect. And Superman calls the move knocking the batters out of the box.
Yeah.
So,
this next scene cracks me up too. Because he built a robot that just is like for entertainment, and his whole purpose is to box. And Jimmy Olsen gets to throw down with him.
Yeah, I love how in these, Jimmy Olsen is kind of, it's the most badass interpretation of Jimmy Olsen, you know?
That
this period where he's like,
I've seen.
Yeah, he's, you know, he's man of, it's like Jimmy Olsen, man of mystery, you know? Like, he's like a pulp action hero. And that take on him is pretty cool, you know? You know, we've seen him accomplish a lot, and boxing a robot is just another thing to add to his list of accomplishments. But we find out that, you know, he didn't really, like, he can't knock out a robot made out of steel. And he shows Scrapper that he actually managed to find and press a deactivator button on the robot while he was fighting it, and that's how he ended up winning.
I don't know how he found a deactivator button in midstream during a fight, because they're boxing essentially.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little bit of a stretch there, but
it's almost like he coincidentally, like when he's fighting him and he says, "This has got to do it," it's like he throws a punch and accidentally hits the button. Or he knows where the button is and then he throws the punch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess technically it would be a little more believable if he accidentally hit it and didn't know how he accomplished it, and then they looked at it and oh shit, I got lucky there. But
and if villains would be smart, like if I was Victor Volcanum and they escaped the next route and I gassed them, I would just kill them. Why not just gas them with deadly gas that'll kill them instead of knock them out?
If you decided to become a villain, it would be scary for everybody, because you've done so much research. If you take in all the content,
there would be no speeches.
you've done a lot of research. If you decide to use your powers for evil, that'd be pretty scary.
I don't need to boast.
No. It's like, do not explain your plan to the superheroes.
Yeah.
But the Victor's spent a lot of time, all those years, he's built a lot of machines, and he's got one called Brain Blocker that he shoots through a hole in the ceiling and manages to knock out our gang of good guys there. Mm-hmm. And then he's planning on making his escape to go on to his conquering of the world. And I did really like the fact that he's dressed up in his like this purple and white and yellow uniform. Looks like kind of like a futuristic version of the outfits like the guard wear outside of the royal palace in Britain, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the big black hats,
sure,
and stuff.
The ones that never the ones that never blink or move. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And I notice he has like spurs on his purple boots, like he's a cowboy.
He needs it for the balloon.
Yeah, yeah.
A balloon with no balloon on top of it. It's just the bottom part.
Yeah. So so that's pretty impressive. We have a kind of a long action sequence at the end where he's trying to take off to, launch his plan, which involves this this thing called the Hyper Spinner. He's off towards the shores of Metropolis at this point, and I guess the Hyper Spinner kind of it basically spins his vehicle that he's in, to create a force that's gonna destroy the city or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Being the fact that he's up against Superman, he doesn't really have a whole lot of chance, especially when he decides to attack Superman's city. But he, you know, once he gets to the point, Volcanum gets to the point where he realizes that he's maybe not going to be successful in his desire to dominate mankind. You know, he tries to take he takes himself out, tries to take Superman with him by blowing up his gondola, but naturally, you know, it doesn't do much to Superman, so he basically takes himself out when he realizes he can't have his desires, and he's proves he is actually pretty nuts.
Yeah. And the whiz wagon just barely got out of there. Superman had to, like, launch it.
But I like that. So they're finally, they've been away from Metropolis for quite a while, and they're all pretty excited to take a bath.
Well, which they were excited about in the last issue. That's where they were headed before they maneuvered over a volcano.
Oh, yeah. So we'll see next time if they actually get there this time. They're pretty close now.
It'll be like a big barter scene, except the Newsboy Legion will be in the bath.
Yeah.
So this feels good. And then we get a 2-page story about the genetic criminal.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually, when I started reading it, I thought the guy without a shirt was the bad guy.
Yeah, so did I, actually.
Yeah.
But he's kind of, this is another Tales of the DNA project. This guy that they created, this guy with the, just kind of wearing blue shorts and boots, he's, he used his ESP to discover that, I guess this soldier was gonna, he's a foreign agent, so he's like a spy. He uses ESP to discover that that there was a spy in their midst, and he takes him out, and he's model number 4, apparently, and he was, even though he was grown from the cell tissue of Floyd Bullets Barstow, a gangster executed for murder, he never did prove antisocial. So number 4 was a success.
There you go. This and then that leads us to Mr. Miracle number 8, which had my favorite double page splash of all of them. It was the sexiest, of course, because you got the female Furies all in one shot. But I love this issue, man. I don't think there's an issue of Mr. Miracle that I have ever thought got bad or anything. It's just that maybe it's because I like Scott Free and I like Big Barda so much, and Oberon, you know, every time he shows up, I just love those panels.
And, yeah, they're great characters.
And it just seems like they've always been escaping traps and stuff because, you know, Granny Goodness is always sending somebody down there to give them hell. And in this, in the last issue, they had captured... I found this issue a little weird because in the last issue, they captured Scott Free and they captured Big Barda. And I thought we know that they sent Big Barda to the female Furies, but I thought they would send her in chains. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I thought they'd send her as a villain, you know? But mm-hmm. they sent her to the female Furies, and she just pretty much took over the female Furies again. And they send Scott into this... what was it called? Section something? Section 8? I don't know.
Zero.
Section Zero.
Yeah.
And that was interesting because that was like, you think, well, it's going to be a battle with the Lump. Well, the lump is just this big purple beast that is really a lump. Like, it can't do anything. It just sits there on a table. But once you're once you're connected to the machinery next to the Lump, you're pretty much in the Lump's mind, or he's in your id or something like that, they explain.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where they both sent them to. I love the art in this. But when they send Big Barda to the female Fury, she's fully dressed in her armor, and they get there, and they're actually having a contest, if you will, to who's going to be the next leader of the female Furies.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they're kind of just in disarray, like, without her leadership. I guess, I mean, why they didn't bind her up, like you said. But basically, she just, you know, kicked the shit out of the guys that were escorting her. You know, that's our first panel of the page. And like you said, I flipped over the double page spread, and it's kind of like, it almost looks like a dressing room backstage, like
a beauty shop.
Beauty show or something like that, where
at least the chairs look like beauty shop chairs.
Yeah.
So.
It's like an alternate reality where most of the like beautiful women are like a bit larger and curvier than in our day and age. And I flipped over this double page spread and I'm like, oh my gosh, Kirby drew Mike's wet dream.
It was awesome. I had to stay on that page forever. I like this one gal that I think she shows up later. The one gal with the big sniper rifle that's just sitting on the chair.
Oh, yeah.
And it's, I'll put more thrust in my weapon than any power drunk nut in this outfit.
Yeah, I thought she was naked at first.
Yeah, it's like she's just wearing a belt and a little strap.
Yeah. But, yeah, the female furries are cute. I mean, there's like the ones that we've met before, you know, Mad Harriet and Lashina and stuff. And then we get briefly introduced to some others throughout the issue. And a lot of them, I mean, they might have one particular power or gimmick that they're, you know, they're known for. Like at one point we see one who has really big boots. I think she's called Stampa or Stampina,
yeah,
or something.
She's Stampa. She's one of the
Stampa
major ones that they show in comics today. Like when the female Furies showed up, it's like Mad Harriet and Lashina and Stampa.
Mm-hmm. We also see Guillotina.
And there's the vampire one, which I don't think we've ever seen here, at least in this comic.
Yeah.
We haven't seen her yet.
So while Big Bart has taken charge of the Furies again, we have Scott Free. What's going to happen is that they're going to actually put him into the Lump's mental space. And this is where the Lump basically lives his life out. Because in this mental space, he's able to actually move around and change his shape and stuff. They call it a psycho merge. And watching is not only Granny Goodness, but some other people we've seen as we've gone along here, Vermin Wunderbar and Kanto.
He's very interesting to me because his banter back with Granny, it's like Granny doesn't trust him either.
No, she's like, you're an assassin. If you would kill me if Darkseid told you to. And he said, yeah, you're right. He said, but I would do it respectfully, I'll tell you that. But even more interestingly, we have a prisoner brought in, an infamous prisoner who has the scorn of Darkseid himself. And she pulls off her green hood to reveal that it is Orion's mother.
Yeah, I didn't know why they brought her to see this, because I thought she was in the shit. Like, I didn't think she was in fate. Well, she's obviously in chains when they bring her.
Yeah.
Why would they bring her for entertainment to see Mr. Miracle die? I didn't understand that. She knew that they took her son away, but I don't know if she knew about the exchange. Did she know about the exchange?
Trying to remember. I think perhaps when they have that scene of her being upset with Darkseid for it, I think
She knew they were taking her kid away for peace.
She may have, but I don't know if so. I don't know if that,
because this is many years later.
Right. Yeah. Because we're talking about when Scott Free was a baby in Orion. I think some of it perhaps is it may just be that, you know, no matter you know, how much of a criminal she is considered to be. She still ultimately was Darkseid's wife and the mother of his child, so maybe she's just afforded some, you know, some privileges.
Yeah.
But she kind of says, like, she wouldn't normally even accept the offer, and she kind of seems to have some disdain for Granny Goodness and this type of shit that she does, but she seems as though as time is going on, she's just getting more and more lonely sitting in her cell. So she started taking the opportunity to get out and see other people. And we have the battle basically between Lump and Mr. Miracle, and Lump keeps changing shapes and doesn't seem like Mr. Miracle has a lot of a chance. He transforms into a deadly woodsman, and he looks like Santa Claus. And the outfit that he has on, it's like red and white.
Yeah, he puts him through quicksand initially. Mm-hmm. He gets out of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he tries to, like to smother him. Or no, he turns into the woodsman, like you were saying. And then he has that porcupine scene, which I thought was the best. Because him and he's as the woodsman, they're like going in hand-to-hand combat. Mr. Miracle punches him, and he turned into that porcupine. He's got all the quills right in his fist. He's like, damn, that hurt. And then he starts shooting, like, the quills at him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets caught in a vine, and then he, like, just tries to light him on fire. And then, meanwhile, one of the female Furies is there flirting with one of the guards. Like, I guess he was hitting on her in the past, and she just rejected him. Guillotina. Mm-hmm. Is her name.
Yeah.
And he's happy that he's not being rejected now. And he says something like, sure, it takes a little time for a wildcat to simmer down and start purring. And she said, shall I purr for you, my sweet? And she pretty much knocks him out.
Yeah.
And then all the female Furies come through, start fighting. I just don't know how she would gain control of all the Furies, because I thought they had loyalty to Granny Goodness, you know, and here they were fighting with their leader, Big Barda, after she took over, like, pretty quickly. She pretty much grabbed Lashina and Mad Harriet and just threw them, and then she was in charge.
Yeah, I mean, I also did go into the issue with the impression that I didn't realize that they had the loyalty to her, but I don't know if, you know, I could believe it. I don't think there was too much to contradict that.
But when we see them in the previous issues, when they're on Earth, they're there to kill her, and they're not holding back.
Yeah.
But they pretty much go in there, and Mr. Miracle is fighting the Lump to no avail. It looks like it's like they're fighting equally. In other words, I think it gives you the impression that they'll be fighting for all eternity, like it'll never end. Because Mr. Miracle is getting almost in situations where he kills, then he gets killed, and then he escapes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one after another after another. And when Big Barda arrives, Granny Goodness says, I have killed Scott Free. Scott Free is dead.
Mm-hmm. She calls Big Barda a traitor, which doesn't go well.
Yeah.
I do like that. I do like the panel where we get to see Bernadeth, Desaad's sister, confront Kanto. It's kind of neat. They almost kind of look like each other.
Yeah, they do.
But, so yeah, this is where we see Stampa. They break into the room where Mr. Miracle and Lump are strapped to the tables. And, you know, no surprise, Scott Free actually did escape and win, and then goes on to, you know, like a lot of these episodes have a feel of a, you know, a magician, and have that structure where we see him escape, but then we get to see him explain how he did the trick, kind of.
Mm-hmm.
So in this case, he was able to find a reflective surface and it was showing Lump the side of himself that that allowed him to prevail, that he was, instead of using physical combat, he used psychological warfare, which appropriate considered this episode, or this issue is called The Battle of the Id. So, you know, ultimately the Lump was undone by the fact that he has poor self-esteem.
I'm going to have to play that song for this episode. She's Lump.
She's Lump, yeah. Yeah, this will be our... We don't want to miss another opportunity.
Yeah.
So our preview is that we'll be having... Not won't be in our next batch, but the next time we come around to Mr. Miracle, we'll be learning some more about the... we'll be first learning about the Himon, the escape artist of the age. It's the one that trained Scott Free and... also built the first mother box.
I'm glad you pronounced it like that instead of Hyman.
Yeah. I felt like that was probably the way to go. But next time what we will have is the Forever People number 9, the New Gods number 9, and we will have Mr. Miracle number 9 next time.
We just don't have a Superman.
We don't have a Jimmy Olsen for a while for some reason, so. And I'm also excited to see we'll be getting some Dead Man coming up in Forever People.
Oh, yeah.
So that's going to be a cool appearance to have him join the story in the next couple episodes, next couple issues of Forever People.
That was pretty damn awesome issue. I gotta take a picture of that spread and put it on my my wall, because it's definitely one of my favorites. There's another one that's coming up, I think, in one of the New Gods that has Forager or whatever in it, and I love that page too. Mm-hmm. So that was the Kirby part, and then I guess we could answer questions. I think we only have one.
Okay, yeah, I know. I don't know if anyone put anything on your page.
No.
But we do have some questions from Bob Franz on the Geek Brunch podcast page.
Is it Bob or Norbert?
Oh, did I say Bob? Norbert. Sorry about that, Norbert. He's got a few questions here, like a multi-part question here. He says, how retro should you be? And it's kind of a two-part here. How much time do you spend with old comics and related items? For me, it varies. I kind of go through phases. Obviously, I'll always be reading the stuff for every other week or so for the show, and then in between, I kind of go through phases. Sometimes I mix, when it comes to comics at least, sometimes I mix it up. I do, you know, back and forth between older stuff and newer stuff. And then sometimes I get into a phase where, you know, I really just read old stuff for a while, and I let the new stuff pile up, and then vice versa. You know, I'll realize I hadn't read any new stuff for a while. I'm getting behind, and I'll start pushing through some of that stuff. When it comes to stuff outside of comics, generally sort of the same way, but I can go quite a while in general without watching many movies. But every once in a while, I'll get in a phase of watching older movies, because I'm definitely a big fan of, like, 70s movies and that kind of thing. Really, it just varies for me. I always like to mix it up and vary. I mean, I know some people tend to just take in what's new, and I find that I enjoy new and old stuff better if I'm varying the two.
Yeah, my answer's very similar. I like to vary the material, and the reason I wanted to start this cast is it gave me an excuse to read some of the stuff that I wasn't reading, because I have an inhumane amount of books I need to read, and it's like if you were turning on a fire hose, like it was always on, and you never like turn it off. That's how I get my comics. It's like a fire hose.
Yeah.
So what you hear in this podcast is pretty much all the retro. I mean, everything I talk about is the older stuff that I read, which is like 10 years or older. And then everything else you get in the other podcast that I do, which is, you know, all the more current stuff. But
yeah, that's true. Between your 3 shows, you probably cover a lot of stuff that you're reading, whereas I'm most of the time just on here, so barring a guest appearance here or there, yeah, it depends. I mean, but so I also do, but I don't talk about everything old that I read on here. A good percentage of it, but I will sometimes just either be working my way through a run of something that I haven't read, or that I'm, you know, rereading, that I don't end up just time reasons or whatever, may not touch on the show. I don't know. I like being able to do that too. Like one thing with new stuff, it's always fun sometimes to just be able to read through a long run in a short period of time, you know, to not be constrained by release dates, to just be able to bust through like several decades worth of a title if you wanted to, yeah. You know, if you're going back far enough.
I usually do that every week on current stuff, because I have it accumulate.
Mm-hmm. No, and sometimes that's nice to do too. Like I have like some mini series that are just wrapping up that I just decided to wait till I collected the 4 or 5 issues, and I'll probably do that only if I'm certain of the creators, you know, and I know that I'm gonna like it or something.
Yeah,
but sometimes it's a nice way to read, and sometimes it's nice to be up to date on certain things and be, you know, just a part of the conversation happening. You know, I think that's another reason too, like, that I find myself flip-flopping, because obviously, you know, when you're reading stuff from the 80s, there might be other people reading it coincidentally, but you're not a part of the conversation of excitement about what's going to happen next, you know, where like people maybe are theorizing or offering their interpretations of what's going to happen, because everybody already knows what's going to happen. Like, mm-hmm. You might not yet, but no one's out there theorizing, because it's already been documented. You know, it's already happened. So it's good to have a little mixture of that too, of like going back and experiencing and reading stuff maybe you missed out on that's considered to be really good. And then sometimes it's fun to be a part of what everybody's talking about and have your own kind of, even if you have it privately, have your own kind of guess at what, you know, the end of the story might be.
Yeah.
So, and the other part of his question was kind of interesting. How old does a comic or a movie have to be, in your opinion, to count as retro?
Well, we have that rule of 10 years.
Yeah, we have that for the show. Do you kind of, in your personal estimation, do you kind of also think of it the same way, or
no? I think more when I think retro, I think more like when I was a kid.
Yeah.
In other words, I consider being an adult when you like turn 17 or 18, and you're kind of you've hit that crossroad where you're like, I have to do something with my life, and mm-hmm. and then you hit that fork in the road where you're kind of like leaving, mm-hmm. and that's where I think where my childhood was, is where I think of retro, just historically. But I want to, I opened up, when we started the show, I wanted to open it up to earlier too, because, You're a lot younger than me, for one thing. And I have a lot of 90s stuff and 2000s stuff that I haven't read yet. It's in boxes, and I want to read it. So.
Yeah. No, I think that that's... I think the 10 years thing is a good choice for the show because, you know, obviously 2013, so that would mean 2003. And I mean, like, that's old enough that it's not stuff that a lot of people are talking about, you know. Uh-huh. It's old enough that if there's something that we intended to read from like the early 2000s and haven't at this point, then it has slipped far enough back into the backlog or our memories that I think it's a good demarcation. And like you said, if we sort of have that rule irregardless of guests or something like that, if, you know, if we had guests that are, you know, are even younger than myself, it would also be applicable to them too, you know.
Yeah.
10 years, like, so yeah. But yeah, I also similarly, I don't really think in my own thoughts of something from the early 2000s to be retro. I would also say, like, for me, I guess my mind retro also means stuff that I grew up with. So for me, it's like 80s and older. I tend to think of as retro. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would feel like 90s are retro for a lot of people, but to me, like, 90s is what I think of as, like, I mean, for me, that those were high school and early college years. So I think of them as, I guess, between retro and modern.
Modern age.
Yeah. Defining moments, defining era. The 90s are the reasons that sometimes I still look like Kurt Cobain taught me how to dress.
Yeah. So, yeah, movie-wise, retro stuff, I think I watch at least one a week, but I don't watch a lot of TV. I read a lot of comics.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, last night we were watching Rocketeer, which is probably my favorite comic movie of all time. I don't know what it is. It's the simplicity about it. It's the pulp of it. I'm fascinated with the 40s. I mean, like, I'm just totally not just because of the wars and stuff and the situations mm-hmm. that people found themselves in. And yeah. I'm even finding myself any time before the 40s too, you know, is to be very interesting to me. And, but me and Barb, like, we'll turn on the TV and see, like, one retro movie. We might not catch it at the beginning, but we'll finish watching it, like, every week.
Yeah. Yeah, I gotta see Rocketeer again sometime. I saw it when it came out, or maybe when it first came on rental or something. I think that might have been the case. We might have gotten it from Blockbuster or something.
Yeah.
I gotta see it again because I think, you know, it's been so long and I'm a different person. You know, I would like to see it as me now. But, you know, right now it's the summer. We don't tend to watch a lot of TV. But, you know, in the winter, we'll watch movies a lot more often. And actually, we were in Pittsburgh last week and we were driving back. Kara was slipping through some entertainment magazines because we got like a subscription to that for a while for like $2 or something.
Entertainment Weekly or something?
Yeah, yeah. I think Kara signed up to it to contribute to a charity or something, so we had it coming for a while. And so she was slipping through those while I was driving. And to kill time, you know, they had an issue where they had like their top 100s of everything. So she started naming off, you know, the movies that were listed, and we were to say if either of us had seen them or not. And afterwards, I was saying, you know, this winter, like, we should both pick out some films that we always wanted to see and never did that are older, you know, and watch those. Because a lot of times we'll just kind of, you know, grab some Blu-rays or, you know, whatever happens to be around and then make a choice. Or we'll, you're getting a run of just watching recent stuff that came out, you know?
Yeah.
So we're going to try to maybe do that. So if I end up watching some older stuff. But that's another thing I went go through phases. I mean, there was a few years ago where I was just watching movies like a maniac. But it's just almost so much time. Like, when I was doing that, I really wasn't reading very much comics, you know?
Yeah. I go through phases, too, where I just want to watch TV. And, like, I finally finished seeing Spartacus. Like, it took forever, but once I got back into it, I couldn't stop. Like, we were watching one a night. It was one of those things where just like, okay, it's time for Spartacus. I love that series, man. That was so good.
Sometimes it's like you got to get yourself to do that first one.
Yeah.
And it takes you a while to do it, but then once you do it...
Once you get the momentum going, it's like, holy crap, I can't stop. Got to keep going.
Totally.
And the same thing happened when we were watching Bates Motel. We were going through that. We were watching Psycho the other night, and it was just at least part of it. Mm-hmm. And it was very interesting seeing that movie and then like relating it back to the TV show, you know?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's pretty neat.
I remember staying up late. I think it seems like a perfect... I don't know that I really did it on purpose, but it seems now like a perfect way to have done it. I remember staying up late after everybody had gone to bed to watch Psycho. It was on TV late at night. And at the time, I guess in high school or something, I started getting curious about old movies and watched it that way. It seems like it was a good choice on my part.
It's still pretty freaking creepy, especially when he's always talking to his mom and then, you know, his mom is dead and he's really talking to himself. That's the creepy part of it. And I still find the scene very creepy at the end where he's in like in the room and the flies buzzing around him and he's talking to himself and he's like, I'm not gonna swat that fly, and he's talking in his mom's voice.
It's like
creepy. Sometimes movies can be really scary without explicitly showing you what is happening, you know? Some of those older movies can be really frightening. Now they don't leave much to the imagination. They show you everything. If a head's getting cut off, they show you the head getting cut off or what.
Yeah, and I guess it's a place. I feel like there's a place for both. I mean, some people only like one or the other. I mean, I have an appreciation for like a gory movie, and a lot of times those ones aren't really movies I watch to be scared. It's more like the visceral thrill of seeing it, and as long as I know it's fake, I can kind of watch whatever, you know.
Spartacus is one of the most real. When they cut somebody's head off, you see it being cut off, or if it's being split, or it's crazy, those fight scenes, man.
Yeah, and there's gore that's kind of, you know, like exaggerated and extreme and kind of almost funny in a way.
Yeah.
And then there's gore that's unsettling because they've, with technology today, they managed to make it actually pretty realistic, you know?
Yeah. Well, there was one scene I found really troublesome because there was a scene where the Romans had captured a lot of Spartacus's army, and they had like these games where they would just torture these, you know, gladiators or the guys that fought with Spartacus. And they had like tug of war on somebody, not with horses, you know, like you usually see where they'll pull somebody apart, but with actually like Romans just getting on each, you know, like each arm and just pulling.
Yeah.
And like, man, I was like, wow, what a way to die.
Yeah, usually like as bad as stuff in movies are, there's something that's happened in real history that's even worse.
Yeah.
Like the unfortunate creativity of torturers is pretty insane. What human beings have figured out to do to each other.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, how did we get here?
I don't know, but we did. And do you want to go into the comics that we read for the week?
Sure. Yeah, we can do that. Now, if you want to start out, or if I can, mine were suitably, in terms of a segue, mine were suitably destructive and catastrophic.
What were they?
And content. Well, I continued my my Infinity Gauntlet quest. Just to try to smash together the titles of everything. Because I finished up I did the other issue of ThanoQuest, which I believe I never read. We discussed last time how these are kind of rare issues. I read them on Marvel Unlimited, and I know I had the first one when I was a kid, and I just don't think I ever got my hands on the second one. And reading it, you know, I felt like I was reading it for the first time. This is, again, Jim Starlin and Ron Lim, and this title, Games and Prizes. And, you know, last time Thanos had tracked down the first three Infinity Gems, and so naturally this is about him tracking down the other three. And actually I found this issue better than the first. I felt, well, you know, I enjoy the creators, and it was a good story and everything. I felt that issue one was a little bit by the numbers, that, you know, you had him going, getting three of the gems. He showed up at each place. He really was super powerful and didn't get challenged very much by any of the three elders that he went after. And this time it's a little bit more, at least it makes you feel like he's being challenged a little bit more, even if it turns out he's not. He first shows up, Thanos, that is, to see the Collector, who is a cosmic being that does just what he is called. He collects things, including rare beings, and that's really what he does, and doesn't really have a sense of morality about it. Thanos says, you know, we've worked together, and I have some respect for you, so you know what I've been doing, and I'd rather not destroy you, so I'll make you a trade. And he said, and Collector's like, okay, you know, if you can find something that is worth enough that I'll give you my gem, you know, then so be it. So Thanos, he waits, actually, after he leaves, and he's thinking to himself that if the Collector actually knows how to use his gem, he's going to take me out, or try to take me out right now. And because Collector doesn't do anything, he knows that the Collector really doesn't know how to use his gem, because it turns out to be the reality gem. And so, you know, it gives the possessor the ability to warp reality. So Thanos heads off to another elder, Runner. And, you know, these guys, they basically are all named after what they do. And this guy has a gem of his own, and he actually seems to be giving Thanos a fight at first. But once you're at the point that you're kind of, you know, you're kind of convinced that that's the case, Thanos in the background has been using his time gem that he got last time, and he uses it to make the Runner super, super old. He says, you know, you seem to be immortal, but you're actually not. You just live a really, really long time, and you might even live for thousands of years in this elderly state. But I can just, if I want, also reverse the process, and he instantly turns him into a baby. And takes his gem, and the Runner actually has the space gem. He thinks it makes it faster, but he's actually just warping space to appear somewhere sooner, and thinking that it's his running that's making him get there. So, and what I was actually a little surprised by this, what Thanos takes back to the Collector to trade him for his gem is Runner himself as a baby. It says, how would you like to have one of your fellow elders in your collection of beings? And this is sufficient, so...
Aren't they kind of like brothers and sisters, though?
Yeah, they are related somehow.
Oh, that's just weird. It's like, yeah. I'm going to keep my brother in this little bubble or whatever.
Yeah, it is pretty fucked up. And
yeah, it's pretty fucked up.
And it comes back to bite him because Thanos gets the gem, which Collector doesn't really, never really bother to take the time to learn how to use. He's just focused on amassing stuff. And so Thanos gets his hand on the reality gem and immediately just like, just to show off, warps the reality of the room and the way that Lim chooses to represent that. It's almost like he drew the scene and then spun it so that it's swirled a bit. It looks pretty cool. And then it turns out that the spell that Thanos cast on Runner was temporary. So the Collector's sitting there holding him in his baby form, and all of a sudden he turns back into adult. And he's like, what were you going to do to me? You were going to keep me imprisoned in your vault here. Are you crazy? And Thanos basically leaves them to destroy themselves. So finally...
The Collector's the old-looking dude with the crazy hair that looks like Einstein, right?
Yeah, yeah.
The white hair.
Yeah. Yeah, he definitely has white hair, and it's just kind of, you know, he has this big wall of prisons with all these weird creatures from all over the galaxies.
I've always liked that kind of villain, the guy who collects things.
Yeah, he's definitely not the only one in, like, comic
books. DC's had their own share of, like, I think even Despero, before he became that bulking, he used to collect them as, like, pieces or play games with them. And I used to like the collection. That's what Contest of Champions was. It was a collection of heroes that fought heroes for some kind of competition.
Yeah, there's even an aspect of that to kind of, like, the hunter characters, like Kraven, you know? I mean, they're more about tracking down the characters, but they always have, like, their trophies.
Yeah, he's kind of a bastard about it.
Yeah. So Thanos has 5 of the 6. Naturally, he goes for the last one, and this one is held by, it's the Mind Gem, and it's held by Grandmaster. And the Grandmaster, at this point, he's been watching Thanos, he knows all about what he's doing. He's also learning about the Infinity Gems as a result, and has designs on them himself. And he's also got his Mind Gem locked up in a... device that will, basically transport the Mind Gem to a random spot in the galaxy and then self-destruct if Thanos just straight up takes him out, unless Thanos agrees to, basically, as a grandmaster of games, you know, he wants to play this game with him. They sit down and they put on these headsets, and it's like, they're transported to this other reality, and I'm totally thinking, like, this is, they're going to play Xbox Live for the last Infinity Gem. Because basically, like, they put on these headsets and end up in this, like, multiplayer arena where they have battle armor suits on. And so, you know, Thanos essentially tricks him. Grandmaster has his own plot where he's going to try to trick Thanos and get the other 5 gems for himself, but you know, Thanos walked up possessing 5 out of the 6 gems in the first place, so he had used them to create a double of himself, a robot double of himself in the first place, and makes quick work of the Grandmaster at that point. There's not a lot of doubt at any point that Thanos is going to prevail, but that's not really what the series is about. It's just kind of about seeing him collect these gems. You know that he's going to do it. And I just felt like this issue was a little more creative in the encounters and how they played out. I found them enjoyable. So now, you know, Thanos' whole deal is that he wants to be equal with death, and he wants, as he gets more and more powerful, it's easy to forget that he is actually, you know, a being with emotions, and he wants death's love. So, you know, he goes back now that he's collected the gems, and thinking that he could win Death's favor and be her equal and sit on a throne as the king to her queen. Death always speaks through two of her minions, the ones that excavated Thanos' corpse in the first place, this rat-looking guy and this corpse-looking fellow. And Death speaking through the rat man, saying, "You're not my equal now. You're my superior. You know, I'm subservient to you. You're now master of the cosmos that I'm just a part of." And this is not what Thanos wanted. You know, he wanted to, be equal with her. He wanted her love as an equal, not to make a slave out of her. So in his frustration, he blasts the rat man, and just like the rat man explodes in a, and just this explosion of blood, and that splatters on Death's face, because she kind of changes her face from being a skull to an actual woman's face, and just kind of disregards Death, which will be she kind of disregards Thanos, which will be an ongoing theme. And then sort of on a downward note, where Thanos is finds that, you know, he's become God, basically, and he's found that it's sort of a hollow victory. So, I also read some Infinity Gauntlet. I'll pause. I'll jump into those after, you know, you do something.
Cool deal. That sounds interesting. I've never read any of it, so it's all new to me. I've read Infinity Gauntlet, but, I don't remember a lot about it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, it was a cool lead up, and it actually jumps back into Silver Surfer for a while, but the only issues that are on Marvel Unlimited are the ones that I've talked about on the show already.
Uh-huh.
So there's a stretch of like 39 through 50 that continue some of the background lead up to Infinity Gauntlet, but I found, and I'll get into this shortly, but I found that those are kind of recapped in Infinity Gauntlet number one to catch you up. So
nice. So I decided to focus on werewolves this week because, well, one thing that's bad about back issue is some of those authors that write the articles, much like podcasting or any kind of blog that you read, they can suck you into buying stuff that you weren't planning on buying.
Yeah.
And I found a Man-Wolf. I like to read a lot about, like, if there's an article about Superman or Batman or something like that, I don't tend to gravitate to that. I tend to gravitate to the articles about things that I don't know about, because, you know, I've been reading Superman since 70 or whatever.
Yeah, so I might just be recapping stuff here.
Yeah, that I've already read. And I will read those articles because they are informative, but I tend to navigate to things that, you know, wow, I don't know anything about this character. Let me read about it. Mm-hmm. And I read about Man-Wolf, but I'll get to that later. There's some guy that was selling his collection. My comic shop is probably the best in the... It's not the best in the city for, like, indies or... it's not the most organized store in the city, but if you want back issues, it is by far the best place to go for back issues.
Yeah.
And he recently acquired a lot of Bronze Age books. Before it was Golden Age, and now he acquired a bunch of Bronze Age books. And I bought a lot. I bought, like, John Carter, Warlord of Mars, the full run. I bought E-Man, which was a Charlton character that I've always wanted to read, with Joe Staton art. And I've never read it. And so I'm buying a lot of stuff that you know, I don't have anything of. One of the things I acquired was at least a 20-issue run of Werewolf by Night. So, and this one I'm talking about, Werewolf by Night number 10 from 1973. It was written by one of my favorite writers, Jerry Conway, with art by Tom Sutton. I've heard of Tom Sutton, and I've seen his art, and this I just haven't seen it in quite a while. So Jerry Ordway, like, I know a lot about. Like, he did a lot of Spider-Man. He really did the hell out of Firestorm, which is one of my favorite characters. And he's written a lot of my favorite Justice League and a whole bunch of stuff. So I was like, man, well, let's see what he do with Werewolf by Night. And this issue was pretty entertaining. I didn't like it as much as the Man-Wolves, but this was Jack Russell. I guess has a sister. Didn't know he had a sister. Don't know much about Werewolf by Night other than, you know, Moon Knight had his first appearance in Werewolf by Night. That's what one of the more popular characters that spawned out of Werewolf by Night. But this guy is in, like, this huge well, very deep well, as a werewolf, and his sister's in there. And there's this villain who's a bizarre villain. His face is masked. And you don't really know much about him other than he's using sound to keep the werewolf and his sister bound in there. So every time the werewolf comes close, he could just play this noise and he falls back, or he's under control of the werewolf. So he can control beasts by using sound. He's like a sound engineer. he was a very smart man. It's like he was hired by this group. It's a very bizarre story. It's like it relates today, like, with what's going on with the Green Team, if you're reading that from DC Comics, and the movement. The Green Team is like the 1 percentile, and the movement is more like the people that are below that, the 99%. And this is about more like the Green Team. There's this committee of financiers that control a lot of things that are going down, and they're realizing that consumers aren't buying things like they should buy it. So they actually hire this villain to cause a stir, I guess to cause destruction, so people have to buy more like wood and all kinds of stuff. They're injecting the economy is what they're doing by causing destruction. So they hire this guy. His name is Sarnak, Master of Sound. And he's got, like, weird hands, like he might be deteriorating, and just a very cloaked look to him. They hire him to cause destruction, and one of his things is if he can take control of monsters and unrelease them in the city, it could cause a lot of destruction. So he does that. You know, Jack Russell's his primary target. And he thinks his sister's going to turn into a werewolf, but she doesn't. But he leaves him down there. Jack Russell escapes and finds his friend, who gives him a device that will counter the device that Sarnak is using. And he does unleash some of his monsters upon New York, and they do cause quite a bit of destruction, turning over police cars, all kinds of stuff, so they're helping the economy. And Jack Russell goes back, and he actually takes down Sarnak because he has that device that will counter the sound control that he has. And you expect, like, Sarnak to be, like, deformed, because he keeps on saying he wears a mask, because much like the villain with the volcano, this guy has a weird origin story too. Which has a modern day twist to it, because this was in the 70s, but this guy got hunted down by people because he was stealing music. Like, he was re-recording things that were on albums, which were a lot harder to do than, you know, just pass a digital thing today.
Yeah.
But I guess he got his face deformed because he got it was ridiculous. But he ended up thinking he was deformed, but he wasn't. Like, he's unmasked at the very end of it, and he looks totally normal.
It's so, like, that I am Napster Man.
Yeah, he was like Napster Man. He was stealing music, and he used his evil to make more instruments for evil of sound. But he was like a sound engineer that just went bad. But it was a cool story. I liked it. It was good, very good art too. Very enjoyable. The cover is, like, awesome. I don't know. Yeah, Tom Sutton did the cover. It has his sister in chains and the werewolf breaking loose, and it's like Jack Russell's going to kill his sister. She's like, no, please stay back. Don't kill me. I'm your sister. And they also capture Jack Russell's father, but they never go anywhere with that. And it's almost like the story's over. So, well, actually, it's not even the same group that captures his father. It's like another set of people. So maybe that's going to continue on to the next issue. It's got an interesting survey at the back, Marvel Comics survey, that you could send in. And it says, I got my comic at a supermarket or chain store, a newsstand, a gift shop, a drugstore, from a friend or enemy or other. And it says, how many comics do you buy a month? And then it says, what did you do with your free time last week? And then it gives you options like watch TV, read a magazine, listen to a record, read a book. Went to a movie, played sports, read a paperback book, read a comic magazine. How many times do you refer to or reread your copy of this comic? That's an interesting one. How many others besides yourself will also read this comic after you finish reading it? That's very interesting. And then it asks, like, parents or other adults, brothers and sisters and friends, do you read advertisements in these comic books? Do you buy things in the advertisements? Which of the following activities do you engage in? And then it lists a bunch of sports like, you know, basketball, football, fishing and stuff. How many cars or motorcycles does your family have? It looks like they're trying to like target advertisements for the comic.
Yeah.
Please indicate the year and make of your car. Do you have a driver's license? Your sex? Do you have any brothers or sisters? What grade are you in? It gives you college, high school, or grade school. Very interesting. Mail your questionnaire off.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like they're trying to target demographics when they didn't have many other means of doing so.
Yeah.
That definitely seems like an interesting plot for Werewolf by Night. Like, not necessarily what I would have gone in expecting.
Oh, hell no. Two interesting plots. You got a guy that's stealing music that turned evil, like, and then you got like the 1%, which is kind of was a hot topic, like, you know, about 6 months or 8 months ago.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's cool. All right. Well, getting into the main event. Finally. Now, like I said, I don't remember and don't believe I had got my hands on ThanoQuest number 2 when I was a kid, but I did, you know, Infinity Gauntlet was talked up pretty big and was a big event, and I did get my hands on those back in the day. So, you know, before I started reading this, and that tends to be the case with anything that I reread from when I was a kid, if I try to tell you ahead of time anything I remembered, I can't really call it up out of my brain, but once I start reading it, I, you know, and see scenes and stuff like that, see the actual comic, it starts to come back to me and realize, you know, that I do recall seeing some of it when I was a kid. Now, we continue with the same writer, Jim Starlin, but this is we actually get George Perez in as the artist. So naturally, you know, I love Ron Lim's art, but naturally George Perez is not anything to not a replacement to complain about. We open with Thanos, and in the meantime, in those some of this detail in those Silver Surfer issues I was mentioning, he's acquired Mephisto as his kind of second in command. His you know, the way they interact is. Reminds me of Thanos is the king, and Mephisto is kind of the wizard in a fantasy tale that is like the power behind a throne. Well, not power, obviously, as he's not as powerful, but the intellect that's kind of like whispering to the king to influence him in a certain way.
Dark side into sod.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Definitely similar. So the two of them are basically just on this like desolate planet, and Thanos is still kind of lovelorn. He still is trying to get Death's affections, and he and Mephisto have kind of disappeared, gone off to this desolate planet while Thanos tries to consider what he wants to do with all this power that he's accumulated. Because he basically is God at this point. But we leave them, and I realized that this was a scene that made an impression on me as a kid. We switch to Doctor Strange, actually, who was with his servant Wong. And all of a sudden, the Silver Surfer just crashes through the ceiling and lands in a heap on their floor. So we get some recap of the stuff that I've already talked about from Silver Surfer and Thanos quests. And then we also get some recap as Surfer catches Doctor Strange up on what has gone on in the issues of Silver Surfer in between Thanos Quest and Infinity Gauntlet number one. Some of which is, you know, Drax the Destroyer and Silver Surfer met up again and tried to take on Thanos with the Infinity Gauntlet. And naturally, they were not very successful. And for a time, Thanos trapped them in the Soul Gem. And they, in the Soul Gem, encounter Adam Warlock, who is kind of basically living there inside the world inside of the gem. And it's Adam Warlock that's able to send them, the two of them, back into reality. So Thanos decides to create a monument to Death to try to impress her. It's this big floating gray stone monolith that you know, has Death's face carved into it, and just this crazy looking thing floating in space. And she's not impressed. She just kind of turns her back on him. So he also conjures up his granddaughter Nebula, who at this point he has twisted into this just malformed, half alive corpse with boils and just all this crap all over her. She's like teetering in this state between life and death that, you know, if it weren't for Thanos' powers, she would immediately die, but he's kept her in this place of stasis, and he's trying to impress Death with his cruelty, because Mephisto suggests, you know, maybe you just haven't become evil enough to be evil in Death's eyes. So he's basically like poking the bear and instigating Thanos. She's also not impressed. She keeps turning her back on him. And when she does talk to him, she talks to him through her only remaining servant, the corpse-looking guy. And just as he did with the Rat Man, Thanos, frustrated that she won't speak to him directly, he wants her to just at least say his name with her own voice. He, you know, just basically winks her servant out of existence. So he destroys her other one and gives her really no other way of communicating, trying to force her to speak herself. Of course, she doesn't. And Mephisto suggests, you know, maybe she's mad at you because you haven't actually done what she initially asked you to do. You've amassed all this power, but you still haven't actually done the duty which she assigned you with, that you haven't gotten rid of half of reality. So this seems like a good idea to Thanos. He walks to the edge of the monument and he lifts up the Infinity Gauntlet and snaps his finger. And Mephisto is even surprised himself that he actually goes ahead and does it. So the rest of the issue we kind of is like a sequence where we see the ramifications of this. We visit, you know, various Marvel superheroes kind of expanding the scope of the story. First with Spider-Man, who happens to be near Times Square, when all of a sudden his spider sense goes off in a really debilitating way. And when he opens his eyes again, he sees half of the people in the crowded Times Square disappear. Switch to Captain America, who who likewise sees Hawkeye and Cersei in Avengers Mansion disappear before his eyes. We get also scenes with Nick Fury, Hulk, who's watching a news report and sees that also it's not just humans, all kinds of animal life and beings across the planet are decimated by half. We go to space and see Sybil, the Empress of the Skrulls at the time, that this is also affecting them, that it's not just on Earth, that it's throughout the galaxy and the universes. Wong, Doctor Strange's assistant, disappears before him in Silver Surfer. And then finally, we head back to Thanos' home planet, and where Eros and is showing up with is it not Firestorm, but who's the Herald of Galactus?
Fire Lord,
right? And Mentor, Titan's father, disappears as well. So, and that's kind of where things turn out, where Thanos has finally used his power to fulfill that mission of getting rid of half of the galaxy. So it's pretty ominous, pretty high stakes established here in Infinity Gauntlet. And I just remember, this really blew my mind as a kid. Mm-hmm. I gotta say, just awesome.
I wish I had easy access to my stuff, and I popped it open and followed along as you were talking about it.
Yeah, it's cool. It's obviously with the George Perez art, he excels at this sort of storyline. And the scope, I read issue 2 also for this time. I can talk about that now, or if you want to do one, I can get back into it after that. But
go ahead.
Just go right into it. All right.
I only have the Creatures on the Loose with Manwolf left.
Okay. Well, like I said, the scope is expanding. I really, issue 2, I remember having this as a kid. I always loved whenever they would show a whole bunch of characters, just like a screen with all of them on. I always liked issues where the Avengers would assemble and draft a new team. And Captain America is taking on his role as a leader and trying to organize the effort of the remaining superheroes. So they have a panel which is basically, Captain America's at the bottom, just kind of like shoulders and head. But most of the page is this grid of all the superheroes. We get to see all the superheroes that have disappeared. And we've seen some of them actually disappear. But it kind of updates us on who disappeared. And it's interesting to see who has and who hasn't. Like all of the entirety of the Fantastic Four disappeared. So they're, as far as teams go, probably the hardest hit. And then followed by X-Force, who at the time was, or X-Factor rather, X-Factor at the time being the original 5 X-Men, and all but Cyclops have disappeared, so 4/5 of that team. Other ones, some of the major ones, Daredevil, Black Cat, Black Panther, Firestar, Hercules, Quicksilver, New Warriors were a thing at the time. So Night Thrasher was one. Wasp, also another big hero, and some maybe considered to be lesser known, Marvel Boy. Shaman, Sasquatch. So yeah, actually looks like now I'm looking at this, Alpha Flight was hit pretty hard too. Guardian, North Star, Puck, Vindicator. So almost, I don't know who exactly was in Alpha Flight at the time, but that might be the whole team there too. So that's a really cool page. I don't know. I just kind of geek out at that type of stuff. But the Avengers are organizing, getting together who is remaining. We have She-Hulk. We have Vision as white, you know, in his white costume. They're trying to figure out, you know, where the X-Men are, because as usual in most of these events, the X-Men are no one's really sure where they're at or what they're doing. Quasar is called into action. He had his own book at the time and was pretty tied into the series. And I find it interesting, Dr. Doom is wondering what obviously he's wondering why half of his subjects in Latvia are disappeared. And he uses his technology to realize that the emanations, like the force responsible for the disappearance, wherever it emanated from, he's also getting some similar emanations coming from the house of Doctor Strange. He's not really sure what the connection is or where the, you know, what's going on, but leads to him heading there later in the issue. Meanwhile, we also see further establishing that this is a major, major threat. Odin, Allfather himself, summons his fellow Sky Fathers, which essentially are the heads of various pantheons. We have Zeus of Olympus, Osiris of Egypt. We have Manitou, an American Indian spirit, Tetzcatlipoca, the Aztec deity, Svarog of Russia, the Mayan god Itzamna, and the Celtic god Nuada. So they are joining forces too, because they've also found their pantheons to be affected. And then we have a kind of a funny sequence for a little comic relief. We get Pip the Troll, who is hanging out watching Elf, the sitcom, drinking beer in his underwear with a bag of chips between his legs. And Adam Warlock, though, calls him into service.
Do they actually say Alf, or is it just the image of Alf?
It's the image. He's watching a TV, and it's Alf on the TV. So Doctor Strange is contacted by this force. He kind of goes into a catatonic state, and a being contacts him and tells him, I need you to trust me. I need you to organize the heroes, and I need to lead them against this threat. And Dr. Strange doesn't trust him at first, but the being says, I will allow you to see my soul, although your soul will also be revealed to me. So Strange decides to take the risk and do so, and finds that the being is trustworthy and is seen many tragedies, and he trusts him as a result. And Thanos continues to lose it, to try to impress Death. At the same time, he teleports Eros, his brother, to their floating monument, and kind of imprisons him in this kind of macabre family reunion. And Eros tries to use his power of persuasion by talking to him. So Thanos makes his mouth just disappear. And that's an image I actually remember having an impact on me as a kid. All of a sudden, his mouth is just gone. Thanos, however, is further enraged by Death's lack of interest in him. You know, he warps the reality of Eros and his granddaughter Nebula, turning them into, you know, geometric shapes that shouldn't exist in reality. Nothing he does is impressive to her. In his frustration, he destroys a red giant star that's 20 million years old. And it creates this kind of chain reaction that calls that gets Galactus of all people, or of all beings, I guess, attention. And while Galactus is not afraid, he realizes that even he does not have the power at the moment to go up against Thanos. But he starts some machinations to do so eventually, but kind of drives home that, you know, how powerful Thanos is at this point. And we also get kind of an insight into that by a recounting of where, you know, the origin of the Infinity Gems in the first place, that there was, when Thanos looked into the Infinity Well, he discovered that there was a being called Infinity. And Infinity, essentially, within her, had the head of all of the cosmos, all of reality within her. And when she shattered herself apart into basically these six gems, and at the same time created reality. And these gems, so you could say that these gems, essentially, the six of them combined, are God, and the possessor that wields them is basically God. So this tidal wave, in a sense, well, they literally become tidal waves, but this chain reaction that Thanos creates turns basically into a wave of destruction throughout the universe. And so the rest of the issue, we get to see some of the effects, especially on Earth, where you know, there's a couple pages where Iron Man is seen, and he's on the West Coast, the West Coast Avengers being a team at the time, and the entire West Coast of the United States falls into the ocean. You know, obviously killing thousands of people, the whole state of California. Tidal waves start to, you know, just gigantic tidal waves start to spread around the globe. Japan itself, the entire series of islands just disappears into the ocean. And, you know, it's, and then just so we know that it's not just occurring on Earth, we see also that the Kree are mobilizing to attack the Skrulls, because they figure that the Skrulls are responsible for their own ramifications. So issue 2 just kind of takes off where issue 1 ended, and just increases the scale of the threat, and basically just the shit hits the fan. The only sign of any kind of hope for the heroes is that, you know, Adam Warlock turns out to be the being that contacted Doctor Strange. And at the end of the issue, he shows up and, you know, reveals himself to Doctor Strange and says, you know, I'm the creature that contacted you. I need to lead and mobilize your heroes. I'm the only chance that you have against Thanos. And Dr. Doom is there as well to figure out what's going on. And, you know, he is not interested in following Adam Warlock. But Dr. Strange and Silver Surfer naturally are. So that's kind of where things are left, that Adam Warlock is going to try to mobilize a force to go against Thanos, who is clearly like losing his mind. So,
did you read Warlock in the Infinity Gems book when that was coming out, or no?
No, I mean that's something that kind of followed on from this, right?
Oh, it was the output of it.
Yeah, no, because
I know Pip the Troll was big in that.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff that goes on, I don't know if I'll go on to read them after this, but a lot of stuff that followed Infinity Gauntlet, I never read, because I stopped reading comics like early in 93. You know, and so a lot of stuff between like 93 and 2000, when I started reading comics again, especially Marvel stuff from that stretch of time, I'm kind of unfamiliar with, so... there was a lot of stuff that, you know, kind of continued this story, a lot of, you know, some more miniseries and all that that I never read.
Yeah, I remember there were two titles. You had Warlock Chronicles and Warlock and the Infinity Watch.
Yeah, and there's like, Infinity War and some more. Like, I mean, this was successful for Marvel, and they tried to kind of repeat that success, I believe.
Yeah, I do have some of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I didn't stick with it that long.
Yeah, I'm not really sure of the reputation of stuff that followed on.
Well, it was Jim Starlin, so...
Yeah, I never really... I mean, I haven't... Anything I've read of his, I seem to enjoy, so... at least from this era. So...
Is Moondragon in there?
I haven't really seen her, I don't think, no.
Hmm.
Seen her much. At least in these first couple...
She's one of those titans, I think.
Yeah,
you mentioned Eros.
Mm-hmm.
When you say that, you mean Star Fox, right? Or is it the other Eros?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I do, and I always think I'm wrong when I think that his name's Star Fox, because I think of like the Nintendo games. I'm like, that can't be the same, but it is. But. So, yeah, I don't know. So far with the Marvel stuff I've been rereading for this show, I've been pretty lucky. I've been reading a lot of stuff that holds up, that I'm enjoying as an adult, even that I enjoyed as a child.
Cool. You're revisiting the past, and I'm exploring stuff I never explored.
Yeah, I'm curious as to... I like doing both, but I'm curious as to how, you know, I'd like to read something that I haven't read before also soon. But, you know, it's tough to choose what I want to read, and it's helpful to have suggestions sometimes. And I'm really glad, you know, Steven, I believe his name, I apologize, forgot that wrong, that wrote in and suggested The Infinity Gauntlet. I'm glad that I had that motivator to get me to revisit these. It's nice checking these out again.
Mm.
It's always fascinating to me to see if something's going to hold up that I read when I was a kid, and if I'm going to still like it as an adult, and probably like it for different reasons, but even if I still like it for whatever reason, it's neat to me. Makes me feel like that's a sign that it's a really good story, that if I could enjoy it as a kid and enjoy it as an adult. Like those Wolverine issues, I'm sure I didn't enjoy them for the same reasons, you know, but I can read them now and get something different out of them.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that's kind of a sign of quality.
So last on my list is I have Creatures on the Loose from 1974, so this is a year after The Werewolf by Night, and this is the first appearance of Man-Wolf in this Creatures of the Loose book. Like, Man-Wolf has already appeared in Amazing Spider-Man, and he's J. Jonah Jameson's son, who's an astronaut, who went to the moon, found a rock, and put that rock around his chest, and when the moon comes around, he turns into a man-wolf. And he has no control over what's going on in his body when it happens. But in this series, in the Spider-Man series, it gives a flashback and kind of tells you where he is. And I guess Spider-Man took the gem off of him, and the curse was gone for a while. But later on, I think it involved Morbius, the living vampire, and the gem got grafted to his chest, so now it's like part of him. It's almost like Blue Beetle's scarab, if you will. And he's on sabbatical now from NASA, and he is the scene opens up with him crashing out of his house, and then it flashes back to talking to his father. This is Creatures on the Loose number 30, 31, and 32. And J. Jonah Jameson is like, he knows he's a wolf. Like, and he's trying to hide it. You know, he's trying to help his son hide the fact that he's turning into a wolf. Well, when he turns into Man-Wolf, he seems to destroy everything that John loves. Like, he'll destroy pictures of his fiancée, and this time he's getting married, and he'll destroy, like, his Air Force uniform, and he just tears everything apart. So he's like the anti... He's destroying everything that guy loves.
Mm-hmm.
And then they introduce this particular cop. He's a real jackass. I don't know who he is. But he didn't last long. So, I mean, he's still in the story, but it seems like they get rid of that storyline.
Mm.
I forget what his name is. He's such an ass. He's like an arrogant son of a bitch.
Mm.
His name is Strode. His last name is Strode. Lieutenant Strode or something like that. And this guy is just a jerk. But he gets the correlation that John might be the Man-Wolf. So he goes to his apartment to see if he's really the Man-Wolf. And everything indicates that he is the Man-Wolf. And then they end up fighting each other on the Statue of Liberty. And Man-Wolf tries to jump at this guy, the Strode character, and he misses and falls off the Statue of Liberty, and Strode thinks he's dead. And that was the end of that issue. So the first issue, you think, well, Man-Wolf might have died. But it's got that continuation thing. And then they have these like bonus features that I think are from Golden Age comics or maybe Silver Age comics, but they're just two-page stories that were, I think, previously published. And it's called Joe's Weak Spot. It's such a weird story. It's about a boxer that commits suicide because nobody will let him box anymore because he's got a glass jaw. It's weird. Oh. that was bizarre as all hell. These backup features freak me out. I don't know. And then you jump to Creatures on the Loose 31. These covers are phenomenal, man. I swear to God, I could stare at these covers for like an hour because I just think they're great. I forgot to mention the creative team. Doug Monk and George Tuska is the artist. And Tuska is the artist on all of these books. Whereas I think on issue 32, Tony Isabella is the writer. So he switches. So only...
Mm-hmm.
The writer switches, but the artist stays the same. So on the second issue, it takes place after the fall off the Statue of Liberty, and he ends up washing ashore and turning back to John. And for some reason, man, I forgot to look up the colorist. It's really distracting as all hell. Michelle Brand does one of them, and... Yeah, they're different colorists. His hair changes in each issue. In one issue, his hair is like a brownish red. And in the next issue, it's gray, like the color of Man-Wolf. It's really distracting. And then in the third issue, it's back to normal. So this colorist really fucked up, at least I think. But this issue 31 was my favorite of all the issues because... it gave all the Spider-Man backstory. It was a flashback as John wakes up after he fell off the Statue of Liberty. It tells you the story of him fighting Spider-Man and the Morbius thing that I've already talked about and how the gem got grafted to him. You know, it gave you all the history that you ever needed to know about Man-Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And then he ends up stumbling through the Daily Planet and finds J. Jonah Jameson, and J. Jonah Jameson starts taking care of him because he's got a bullet in him. And he actually calls a doctor to come see him, and John says, "What the fuck did you do that for? You have to report every bullet wound and all that stuff." And meanwhile, NASA is reporting him for being AWOL because he's been gone longer than his sabbatical was mm-hmm. to get married. And so NASA is sending the FBI after him. And then he shows up at his girlfriend's house. You know, she's crying. She's like, "What's going on? Tell me what's going on." And then the police arrive, and then they take him away. So, and then in the police car, it happens to be dark, or the moon comes out, and then he turns into Man-Wolf and then breaks out of the police car again. And then we get a two-page spread of The Walking Dead. This is a weird story where this guy was always put down by his peers because they didn't think he could bring the dead back to life, and then he brought the dead back to life. And then his peers were like, we never put you down because we didn't think you could do it. We put you down because it, here's what it would do. You know, people would bring their dead back to life, and then we'd have all these dead people walking around. And then he realizes what he did wrong, and he destroys his zombie. But and then we get into the final, or it's not the final issue, but the final issue I'm going to talk about. It's number 32. So in the last issue, you know, he broke out of the police car. In this issue, it talks more about his relationship to Christine and how they were going to get married. And he's Man-Wolf at the time because he broke off that police car, and he's there to kill Christine because he wants to destroy everything that John loves. And Kraven comes into it. We were just talking about Kraven. Uh-huh. And he's like, hey, I want to capture this werewolf. And there's a big fight scene there, and his girlfriend calls the police. She doesn't remember anything that happens because somebody had wiped her mind, so she doesn't remember he's a wolf. But her memories are starting to come back. And as they're fighting in the streets, the police arrive, and they both escape. Kraven and Man-Wolf escape, and John calls his friend at NASA, the one that knew he stole the rock up from the moon, and he says, can you help me? This is what's going on. I'm still turning into the wolf, and it's grafted to my body. And he says, yeah, but you're AWOL now. You have the FBI looking at you. And he said, well, I can arrange a flight out there, and I'll explain everything. So he tries to organize that flight, and that doesn't work well because he turns to Man-Wolf again when he's at night, and Kraven captures him and then ties him up. Uh-huh. And he actually turns him back into John Jameson. So to be continued. Hmm. And then I think this was the interesting article. This one had some letters from the people that have been reading the book. And it's odd because there's people that hate it. Like, why are you doing this book? It's so similar to Werewolf by Night, and I don't like it. And then you have people that are calling in and saying, I love it. Like this guy said, this is a real hateful letter. He's like, after reading it, I have only one request. Please discontinue the Man-Wolf series immediately. George Tuska and Vince Coletta were up to their usual standards, but I read the story twice, and as a reader of 10 years, I don't like it, and I don't see any potential. So some hatred there.
I love reading the old letters. You're like, not much has changed, really.
It hasn't. And it's got a two-page story again, or a three-page story at the end called The Matter of Life and Death. These stories are fucking insane. I don't even know what they're about. But it has this guy that this guy is a gardener for his living. He gardens, and he goes to the same shop every Friday, and he gets his pesticide so he could apply it on the weekend. And that's what he is doing. And the guy that's selling gardening supplies says, I've just changed my Merkel's insecticide to SureKill insecticide, and it does the job. It's cheaper. You're going to save money. So he buys this SureKill, and then he's going to go put it on, but he can't open the can. And meanwhile, he gets the guy who sold the pesticide gets a call from the company, the chemical company, and says, don't sell any of that SureKill. It's not what we package the wrong stuff. It's really like nitroglycerin or something like that. And, you know, it could blow up shit. And meanwhile, this guy's like trying to open up this canister with like all kinds of drill presses and all kinds of stuff. He can't open it, but then he just throws it somewhere into the dump, and it blows up everything. It's just weird. It's like, what? Why is that story even there? Other than to kill three pages. But I'm hooked. I'm hooked. There's, I don't know. I can't explain why I'm attracted to Man-Wolf, but I like the art a lot. Like the next issue that I'm going to explore has George Perez art. It says guest artist George Perez. and Claes Janssen's The Eaker. The writer changes yet for the third time in four issues. It's now David Kraft. So we had, you know, we had Tony Isabella and Jerry Conway, and now Kraft. So I'm really interested to see, because it seems like the book's changing. It's weird because it's like the book doesn't know how to establish itself, so it's really interesting to read. It's like everybody's trying something a little different. And still, it's like, did you ever do this exercise in school, like creative writing, where you did like a continuation of somebody else's story? It's like you have the story now, you have to write two paragraphs, and then you'd have to continue the story.
Yeah.
Well, that's what Man Wolf is. It's awesome. You never know what you're going to get.
That's true. I mean, that's what a lot of comics have been at given times.
Yeah.
When they've like had writers change a lot.
So I'll probably read at least the George Perez issue. I didn't get to the Legion Lost issues just because I had such a busy week. I worked long hours. I worked different sites, and I was like, I just came home exhausted.
Yeah.
And then I got called at night, and it was just like, I couldn't get anything read. I read a lot yesterday, but...
Yeah.
But I couldn't get Legion Lost, so maybe next time I'll finish that. Plus, I had these old covers, and they just looked too cool. Like, it made me not want to read Legion Lost just because of the covers. It's like, I was just attracted to open these books up and see what they were about.
Well, sometimes when you're going through, like, a 12-issue series or something like that, it's, you know, you kind of need like, a short break in between, in the middle or something.
Yeah, and it was a good break. I focused on the werewolves.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking, well, you were saying that I kind of forgot about Man-Wolf altogether, but I also forgot that John Jameson, you know, that it was like, because, you know, I grew up reading Spider-Man, was one of my favorite characters, but I pretty much read what was new, what was coming out in general. And when I was a kid, I read what was new and what was coming out. But when I got back into comics, that's one of the first time I really got curious about going back and seeing the history of some of these characters. And one of the main ways to do that at the time, really the only affordable way at the time, was to get the essentials, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when I went back and I read as many essential Spider-Man volumes as I could get my hands on, and, you know, read a lot of, you know, pretty much read as much amazing Spider-Mans as I could for the first time. And, you know, it made me think about, you know, how that, the whole desire to go back and read retro, like going, like sort of relating to the questions that we answered, that the whole desire to do retro thing kind of arises out of nostalgia, and came about only when I was old enough to have nostalgia, even though the stuff that I read was even older than, you know, what I read when I was a kid. I didn't go back and read stuff from when I was a kid. The first thing I did was to, like, check out the origins of things that I enjoyed when I was a kid, you know?
Yeah.
Like, where did the Spider-Man come from? Like, where did, you know, where did these characters, you know, because, like, Spider-Man, like, one of the big storylines that Eric Larson did was Return of the Sinister Six. And, you know, so you had Doc Ock and Electro, and it's like, so to go back and, okay, if this is the Return of the Sinister Six, when did they first appear, and when did these characters that made up the team, you know, where did they first appear, and what's their history with Spider-Man and stuff, was really all really fascinating to discover that for the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's cool shit, man. And like, I would have never thought even to read this Man-Wolf, like, if I didn't read that article. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just cool. I like it.
Yeah, back issue is really good that way.
Yeah, it's bad in the fact that it makes you want to buy more stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I do think I'm going to buy Moon Knight's first appearance. I'm on the fence on it. And
mm-hmm.
Marvel did a lot of monster books that I'm looking maybe at, like Tales, I think it was Supernatural Thrillers that had the Living Mummy. And they had a book at this time called Frankenstein's Monster. And obviously there's Tomb of Dracula. But mm-hmm. there's some Bronze Age stuff that is really appealing to me in the Marvel area, like Master of Kung Fu. I want to mm-hmm. read some of that. Like Micah talked about it in the last Geek Brunch, and I'm like, I want to read some of that.
Yeah, I read... Like a year or two ago, I read a little bit of Master Kung Fu from about 1980. So, you know, it was Doug Monkey was the writer on that too, and they're really good. Like they kind of in the same way that I've said about the early Wolverine issues in Madripoor, they have a real like 70s B movie kind of feel to them.
Yeah.
Like martial arts, obviously. But yeah, they're really good. Like it's interesting how Marvel in the Bronze Age was when they kind of started reviving the horror and all that stuff that they kind of had shelved. But the like the comics code started to loosen up a little bit, and yeah, it'd be kind of neat if it's like. If taste hadn't changed to the point that stuff's not very popular these days, because a lot of that stuff is really cool.
Yeah. I of the books, I liked Manwolf better than I did the Werewolf by Night, even though the Werewolf by Night had some crazy-ass concepts. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Manwolf was more... I was more interested in it because it just was all over the place. Mm. And the art... I don't know if I've read a lot of art, seen a lot of art by Tuska, mm-hmm. but his art styles, I like it a lot. And it looks like a Buscema type influence, you know? And mm-hmm. He tends to be really good like with the smaller panels, but when he does like a half page panel, it's not as good. It's weird. He gets like really... generic. Less lines, but when he does a smaller panel it looks awesome.
Yeah,
but man, these covers are just striking. At least the first two are. The one with Kraven is not as, I don't like it as much, but I have a few more issues of that, and then I told my comic shop guy to keep an eye on any other Manwolves that he runs across.
Nice. Yeah, it's just fascinating that in the time that we've done this, just how much stuff there's out there to read, and you know, just so much different things to choose from in comics. It's like any kind of mood that you're in.
Oh, you know.
There's something like, you can read.
I was tempted because I had picked up those scalp hunters I told you about and a couple mm-hmm. other things. And I was very tempted to get into that, but the whole Manwolf thing just sucked me up and I just wanted to keep reading it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You know, when they'll be there when you happen to find yourself in a mood now.
Like yeah.
If you want to read some scalp hunter now, it'll be there, you know?
Yeah. Picked up more American Flags and E-Mans from different company. Let's see, I have some from First Comics. I got some more American Flag. And then from Kamiko, I got E-Man. So I got those for $1 a piece. So mm-hmm. it wasn't a huge investment. But I might not even like E-Man. And I invested in a lot of E-Man. But I know I at least like the art. It's really freaking bizarre.
I think it's has a decent reputation, right? It's supposed to be pretty good.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard a lot of people talk about it, but...
No, but I think when I was... Because when I was looking up, try to do some research on like indie stuff from the 80s that is considered to be good. I remember seeing that listed as a series people remembered fondly from, like, you know, the 80s indie stuff.
Yeah.
So, not a guarantee that you'll love it, of course, but at least it's a better chance of it, maybe.
Yeah, maybe next time I'll just tackle the first one, because I don't know much about the characters, so just to find out more about them.
Yeah, kind of sample it like I did with like Coyote and John Sable, and I still have some more stuff like along those lines that when I get the mood to read some more indies from the 80s that I picked up, you know, specifically to talk on about on the show. So at some point I'll get back to some of those.
Cool deal.
So,
all right. I think this was Geek Brunch Retrocast 16, I think.
I believe that's correct.
And of course,
I was wrong last time, so who knows?
I didn't let you introduce yourself. Or us.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Well, we remember sometimes. You know.
I'm Mike and this Chris on the other end. And
I'm Archangel, and Thanos has snapped me out of existence. I'm talking from the past, or I don't know.
He's been shit on a lot.
Oh man, that dude's got. We should do like a series of like superheroes that have been shit on the most in comic book history. Archangel definitely be.
Oh, Daredevil for sure.
Daredevil, yeah. Daredevil's had one of the worst lives ever. But yeah, Archangel, well, Angel Warren Worthington has not had a good time of it, which I liked. I liked in All New X-Men when he, when Angel of the Past is kind of like freaking out, like, where am I?
Yeah.
Why is my future self not around? Why is nobody talking about me?
Uh-huh.
Like, because your life is freaking sucked, dude. Nobody wants to break it to you.
Well, he had the money, but man, he's had it rough, you know. His mutant abilities developed, he became an X-Men, and then the Archangel thing was, like, traumatizing. Mm-hmm. And then he became Angel again, and then he was part-time Angel and part Archangel, and it seemed like he was, like, a split personality for a while, like, current, like, mm-hmm. In the X-Force years, where he's, like, he'll go into this killer mode where he's Archangel, and then he's, like, back to normal. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then he had a healing ability at one time. I don't know if he still has that, like where he was really like an angel.
Yeah, I think that was the Chuck Austin
yeah.
period when he was dating like a 17-year-old.
Yeah, I didn't think she was I thought she was like the X-Men nurse.
Well, there was Annie, the X-Men's nurse.
Wasn't he seeing Annie? Or am I thinking of somebody else?
It might have been a love triangle, but what I was referring to is he was dating Husk.
Oh.
Who I think was supposed to be 17. I don't know. She's either 17, 18, or 19. A lot younger than him. Regardless. Not that that's never happened in comics, but.
Yeah, Chuck Austin gets shit on in that. And I kind of liked his run. Oh, yeah. But I'm not a hardcore X-Men fan either, so.
I think that was part of the problem.
Liked his run, okay.
I think a lot of people hated him because he didn't really give a shit about continuity.
Yeah.
He just wanted to like write the stories and ideas that he had, so he probably was better off not being on a... Like, X-Men was probably one of the worst things to choose for him to write, because it's... I mean, it's big fans are all about the continuity, and if you're just like, no, I don't really care if I'm consistent with what's happened before. I just want to write this story. You're not really going to go over very well.
Yeah.
You know. So maybe some of his ideas and like if it was just a creator own thing might have been cool, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But like you can't do that to this character. Like, I don't know.
I remember his run having Juggernaut in it a lot. And it had some little kid mm-hmm. that used to hang out with Juggernaut. Was it Leech or was it... I don't remember. There was one of those X-Men kids that... And then something happened to the kid and Juggernaut went nuts or something.
Was it Beak?
Maybe it was Beak.
I know Beak was... I think Beak was in Austin's Run a lot.
And he had that nurse in there a lot. Like, she was a major character. And there was something going on with Iceman, and they had Angel in there a lot. And, man, I have to revisit that. We'll have that Chuck Austin appreciation.
Yeah, Geek Brunch Retrocast becomes the Chuck Austin cast and loses all of its listeners. Well, I think one of the things that pissed people off the most was what he did with Nightcrawler. People hated.
What did he do? Because I don't remember.
There was that whole Draco storyline where...
Isn't that what they did in the movie?
Well, they used the character Azazel...
To be his father.
In the movie, but... But, you know, there wasn't, like the focus of the story or anything in the movie and when they brought him in, but,
what's wrong with making him a demon, Nightcrawler's, father? It's kind of a cool concept because you have somebody, well, I'm not good at X-Men, so you have to bear with me. Was he real spiritual before Austin, or was it after Austin, where he was like real religious, like priest like?
It might have been exaggerated. I think it was prior to Austin. I think it was an aspect of his personality, but he wasn't.
He had a lot of faith, and
but it wasn't like extreme. I mean, he was more of like the, well, at least in Claremont's characterization of Nightcrawler, it was more of like a swashbuckler. Was a lot more jovial.
I kind of liked when he became the priest-like, and I don't know who did that, but it's kind of interesting that if he was like that, that he'd have a demon, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. Because when you mess with religion, you think of hell and heaven, right? I mean...
Yeah, I don't remember much of the execution of the story, and I think that that's actually what was the complaint, was how it was executed. That and just, you know, the literal, like a lot of people liked that Nightcrawler looked like a devil but wasn't, and then, like, they felt like it was too literal to just say, hey, he looks like a devil, well, let's make it that his father is the devil, you know, or is a devil, or I think that may have been a part of the complaint, but like I said, I mean, I did read a lot of Austin's Run for whatever reason, but
it's because you loved it.
Yeah. I don't want to admit it. Don't make me come out of the Chuck Austin closet. I will admit, I think at the time I didn't hate it as much as everybody did. I think I, like I said, kind of the same, like, but I think there was a part of me at that era, I just wanted to read X-Men to read X-Men.
Yeah.
I wanted to know I wanted to be current on what was going on with X-Men and also like it was somewhat a matter of same thing with like when I came back to comics, it was because the X-Men movie came out and Chris Claremont was going to be writing the X-Men books a lot, and I saw an article about that in the paper, and that's what got me into a comic shop again for the first time. And then what I ended up reading, I didn't really like, I think a lot of people didn't really care for when he returned, you know, before they gave him Extreme X-Men to do his own thing. And he was writing both Uncanny X-Men and X-Men. And but that's what got me back into the shop and caused me to discover, like, I ended up reading, like, Authority and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I think I just kept reading X-Men for a while because I was just like, well, you know, I want to read X-Men because it's X-Men, and that's what that was one of my favorites growing up, you know?
Uh-huh.
But, so, I don't know.
Next issue is a Chuck Austin tribute.
There we go. Next episode is Chuck Austin cast, episode 1. With your host, Mike Myers. And
we are going to explore the hate.
Mike Myers.
We're going to explore what he did that caused so much hate.
We're going to hit to the bottom of it.
We're going to uncover it.
Yeah. What was so bad that Chuck Austin was chased out of comic book writing?
I thought he went from there to DC and wrote some Superman.
He did write some Superman.
And he didn't have a good Superman run either. I liked his X-Men run better than his Superman run, but...
Well, there you go. I mean, you definitely have more of a connection to Superman, so...
Well, there you go.
People don't like when he touches their favorite characters because he just does whatever the hell he wants, I think.
He shits on them.
Yeah. So, well...
All right, so I'll give our information.
Yeah, otherwise it's going to turn into like a DC Noise wrap-up.
Yeah.
And the episode for a half hour.
I don't know if you heard the last one, but I bailed out. They kept talking.
Okay. I started the
wrap out, and I was like, oh, man, I got to leave. All right, so this is Geek Brunch Retrocast 16. You can find us at geekbrunchpodcast.com. That's where the retro and the regular one get released. Mm-hmm. And we got Forum for Geeks. Scroll down to Geek Brunch, and you'll see Retrocast threads. And you can reach us on Facebook if you search for Geek Space Brunch Space Podcast. And there's threads there. At Mythmaking ETC on Twitter is Chris, and I am at Mike Myers Brunch. And did I leave anything else out?
I don't think so.
Leave an iTunes review. We need one.
Yeah.
We need one. We haven't had one in a while, so if you get a chance, tell us you don't want to hear any more about our personal lives.
Or leave us a review, or we'll start talking about only Chuck Austin books.
Yeah, send us email and let us know what you thought of Chuck Austin.
Yeah.
X-Men. I want to understand more hate. I want to understand it because I didn't hate him. I mean, there's people that are still hating on him today. And
yeah.
I don't understand it, but like I said, I'm not a... I actually think that's kind of when I started reading X-Men. maybe a little bit before Chuck Austin. Who was before him? Do you know?
Well, Joe Casey, maybe?
Yeah, maybe I started before him, and then Chuck Austin came, and I started reading him, and it wasn't as dramatic.
Yeah, maybe not. Oh, I remember one last thing I was going to tell you, that Kara told me that, you know, her mom knows that I do a podcast.
Yeah.
She doesn't really completely understand what it is, but she told me that she thinks her mom thinks that what we talk about on the podcast are like newspaper comics, you know, like...
Oh, like funny
Garfield
Sunday funnies.
And, yeah. I thought that's actually kind of awesome. I like talk about Peanuts for two and a half hours.
Yeah, when I was in Albuquerque last, I saw a newspaper for... It's been like a year or 2 years before I saw one, and I was just thumbing through the Sunday Funnies to see what was still there, you know?
Because
I did used to read the Sunday comics as a kid. As I became more comic-oriented, and I never really paid attention to the paper anymore, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I did too, because my parents always got the paper, and when I'd have breakfast on Sunday mornings, I would grab the comics and then... And flip through those while I was eating cereal or whatever.
Yeah, I'd always grab the comics in the entertainment section, and that was it.
Yeah, me too, yeah. So I'm still today, I'm bad at keeping up what's going on in the world, but I'm like, I know everything that's going on with, you know, entertainment.
Yeah. All right, well, have a good week. I hope it's better, and I hope all the pets are better, and your grandfather's better, and...
Yeah, it looks like everybody ended the week on a good note, and hope you don't have any more blood exploding from your head this week. Next time on Geek Brunch Retrocast, my co-host will be Mike Myers' doppelganger.
Yeah, clone. That
sprouted from his brain, became its own being.
The dark backward.
The evil... Red Lantern, Mike Myers.
Go watch The Dark Backward.
Okay.
That's weird. I don't think you'd ever be able to find it.
I know. I wonder.
It would be like one of those movies that nobody ever watched that...
That just never even... There's like, there are like some interesting movies that never even made it off of VHS. You know, like you can't even get them on DVD.
Yeah.
So.
That's probably one of them.
All right, Mike.
All right. Care. Have a good one. See ya.
Talk to you
Bye.
Next time. Bye.
Come and knock on our door. Come and dance on our floor.
Come and dance on our floor.
Take a step that is new.
Take a step that is new.
We've a lovable space that meets your face. Three's company too. You'll see that life is a ball again. Laughter is calling for you. Now let our rendezvous.